Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Amrit Singh. She's a staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union. She's co-author, along with Jamil Jaffer, of the book Administration of Torture, and we are here today to talk about the torture memos. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So tell us about these memos, what they are, and the legal battle involved in making them public, getting them released.
Well, these memos essentially read as shields from prosecution for government officials who torture prisoners. They are not objective legal analyses conducted by Justice Department lawyers. They are essentially memoranda that ratify the use of torture techniques and essentially support with supporting legal analysis that supports predetermined legal conclusions.
So when did you first know that there were such memos and try to get hold of them?
Well, we knew about these memos at various points of time. One of the memos is an August 1st, 2002 memorandum authored by Jay Bybee, addressed to John Rizzo, acting general counsel of the Central Intelligence Agency. We knew that that memo had existed for a while. It had been the subject of our litigation since 2004. And the remainder of the three memoranda, which were authored by Stephen Bradbury in May of 2005, we got to know about the existence of those memoranda through New York Times reporting sometime, I think, in 2007.
So the New York Times reporting of these, did they actually have them? Did the New York Times have them, or what was the status of their secrecy and their availability?
Well, the memoranda were not made publicly available. The reporting by the New York Times characterized the content of the memos, which essentially, again, ratified the use of torture techniques, even as Congress prepared to prohibit the use of those techniques under the Detainee Treatment Act.
So you have a situation where somebody in the Justice Department, I mean, Jay Bybee was then Assistant Attorney General, that is not a low position, was essentially asked to write something to ratify an already existing policy. Do we know who was making this policy and what the policy really was?
I think all of the facts relating to these memos and the policies that were set in place are still not all in the open. It's clear that there were a large number of high-ranking officials involved, but we don't know all of the facts exactly as to the Bush administration's torture program. And that is why the ACLU has consistently been calling for an independent investigation into the abuse, for the appointment of a special prosecutor to criminally investigate torture and abuse, and the appointment of a select congressional committee to investigate the abuse.
I've been reading these memos, the first one by Jay Bybee, August 1st, 2002. This was before the invasion of Iraq. It was after 9/11. In what prisons were people being held that the order to torture was being used in? And what prisons in general did these memos apply to?
Again, we don't know the details of where everybody was being held, but these were CIA prisoners, and the August 2002 memo relates to interrogation techniques being applied on Abu Zubaydah, who was being held overseas at a black site. It was only later on, in September of 2006, that the CIA prisoners were brought to Guantanamo.
So what was involved in your actually getting your hands on these and getting them released?
Well, it's really been a struggle, frankly. We filed a Freedom of Information Act request for records, including these memos and other documents, back in October 2003. So our quest for the release of these torture documents dates back almost 6 years now. And for most of that time, the Bush administration fought tooth and nail to suppress the disclosure of this information, to insulate it from accountability, to protect the disclosure of embarrassing information. And at every point of time, we had to fight significant legal battles. The August 2002 memo was the subject of, we had got an adverse decision from the district court, essentially upholding most of the information, upholding the withholding of most of the information in that memo. And it was up on appeal before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals when the Obama administration informed us that they were actually considering releasing this document in response to our litigation.
When the court decides, for example, to withhold these memos under a Freedom of Information Act, what is their reasoning?
Well, in this particular case, it was the CIA that was withholding these records, and the district court essentially upheld the CIA's arguments for withholding the memos. And you know, the general argument that the CIA advanced in court was that release of these memos would cause damage to national security, and that it could not publicly disclose intelligence sources and methods that were described in these memos. But as President Obama himself said in a statement accompanying the release of these memos, these interrogation techniques are illegal. They are no longer in use, and there is no damage to national security from turning them over into the public domain.
We're talking to Amrit Singh, attorney at the ACLU. I was in one of these memos, the Bybee memo. He described 10 interrogation techniques. Probably many of our listeners are familiar with the idea of waterboarding, but in addition to that, attention grasp, walling, facial hold, facial slap or insult slap, cramped confinement, wall standing, stress positions, sleep deprivation, insects placed in confinement box, and finally the waterboard. And each of these is described in some detail, and it is surreal to read it. It sounds like a manual from a sadist, and there's this weird kind of coexistence of, on the one hand, torture, and on the other hand, concern for the prisoner's health and not being injured and so on. I mean, just, can you comment on it?
Yes, I think that these memos are really chilling because they describe in clinical detail the torture that is being planned on this prisoner, and at the same time conclude that this torture is not actually torture because it does not inflict severe mental or physical pain or suffering. I mean, you don't have to be a sophisticated lawyer to read these memos and just realize that the legal analysis is just a joke, and that the legal analysis is basically designed to support the conclusion that these methods, these torture methods, are legal. So you know, the thought that waterboarding, for example, is not going to produce severe mental or physical pain or suffering. The thought that waterboarding is perfectly legal, despite the United States being a signatory to the Convention Against Torture, despite the fact that the United States has a criminal statute in place that punishes torture. It's these memos only confirm that the legal advice that was being given by senior Justice Department officials was really just designed to provide immunity from criminal prosecutions.
You only have to imagine for a minute of what it would be like to experience any one of those things yourself to come to a feeling about whether or not this is torture.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that dispersed through these memos is the argument that this is not, that these techniques don't cause severe mental pain or mental or physical pain and suffering because Army officers are subjected to these methods when they undergo training to withstand interrogation from their enemy captors. Well, you know, it's one thing to undergo these methods, undergo these torture techniques when you're informed that you're being trained to withstand enemy captors' interrogations. It's quite another thing to experience these methods outside that voluntary context. It's quite another thing to be subjected to those methods, knowing that you could die while being waterboarding, while being suffocated. So really, it's these memos are, in one word, just shocking.
Tell us about the prisoner, Abu Zubaydah, who the first memo was really written in reference to.
Well, and I think it's a well-known fact that he is a suspected terrorist. It's also a well-known fact now that he was, and the fact that was revealed in one of the memos, is that he was waterboarded 83 times. Now, what's interesting about this is that the Bybee memo itself says that techniques generally lose their effectiveness after several repetitions. But we know that both Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed were waterboarded countless times. Abu Zubaydah 83 times, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times. Now, you know, it just begs a question as to why they were being, why this, if this technique was so effective, why did they have to use it so many times? And, you know, the opinion of Ali Soufan, an FBI interrogator, is significant in this regard. He was involved in the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, and he said that he was able to obtain actionable intelligence, reliable actionable intelligence, through the use of standard law enforcement interrogation techniques without using torture. So, you know, the CIA's claim that these methods were in fact effective is a highly suspect one.
Is there information that was obtained through these methods?
Well, I think that what was obtained through these methods and what was obtained through other methods and what could have been obtained had non-torture methods been used is all up ultimately for examination and investigation. So, I mean, I think that proponents of torture will claim that these methods are effective, that they produce actionable intelligence, but really that claim needs to be examined more closely because we don't know, as President Obama himself said, we don't know what would have been produced if those methods hadn't been used. And besides, regardless of that fact, we know that on countless occasions the FBI objected to the use of coercive interrogation methods on the grounds that they were not only illegal but also ineffective at producing intelligence of a threat-neutralizing nature.
Well, this brings up a very important question, I think, which is that there are interrogations that are done with the intent to get intelligence, and then there is just simply abuse of prisoners. And that happens in every kind of prison. That happens in New Mexico. It happens everywhere. Not just military prisons in which people are hurt, they're humiliated, and nothing is accomplished by it. What is the relationship between these two phenomena, genuine interrogations and abuse?
Well, I think it's actually, you know, at least in this context, in the context of the United States treatment of prisoners held in U.S. custody abroad post 9/11, there is a continuity between interrogation methods that were applied on these high-value prisoners and the kinds of abuse that we saw taking place on the ground in Abu Ghraib. In fact, again, all of the facts are still not known, but we know that many of the techniques that were applied by military personnel in Abu Ghraib can be traced to high-level official orders from Secretary Rumsfeld himself. And again, all of that, the recently released Senate Armed Services Committee also confirms that what happened at Abu Ghraib was not the handiwork of a handful of rogue soldiers. It was traceable to high-level decisions made by high-level government officials. so really all of this evidence as it continues to mount only further underscores the need for an independent investigation into all of the cast of characters responsible for spawning this system of torture and prisoner abuse.
We're talking to attorney Amrit Singh of the ACLU in New York. You're talking about the need for an independent investigation in this, and many people are in favor of that. Where is the Obama administration on that?
Well, you know, we're still hopeful that the Obama administration will allow such an investigation to proceed. Once the OLC memos were released, President Obama did make a statement stating that individuals who in good faith relied on legal advice in interrogating prisoners, that those individuals relying on such advice would not be prosecuted, but he did not say anything about the architects of the policies that ultimately led to the torture of these prisoners, and he did not say anything about the authors of these memos as well.
In addition to torture, there were just a lot of people in Iraq, for example, who were put into prisons who hadn't done anything wrong. How did this happen? Why did they get so many of the wrong people?
Well, that's a fact that's confirmed in many of the documents that we obtained through our Freedom of Information Act requests. We have sworn statements from military commanders that will say that most of the individuals held at Abu Ghraib were of no intelligence value whatsoever. They were simply caught in the wrong place at the wrong time because the military would conduct these dragnets, and people would just sort of get caught in those dragnets and be dragged into prison. So it really sort of ties into the whole sort of military strategy at the time where people were just sort of being arrested and detained indefinitely for prolonged periods of time without any kind of intelligence on them and without any kind of due process protections, and then were instead subjected to abuse while they were being detained. In fact, the ACLU had a lawsuit brought on behalf of Iraq and Afghan prisoners who were innocent, who were detained and tortured and abused at the hands of the Defense Department, just confirms that there was no basis for locking these people up in the first place.
It does seem so entirely contrary to the goals or the stated goals of the larger mission, which was, among other things, to win heart and minds and instill democracy and ultimately friendship between our country and theirs in the case of Iraq.
Absolutely. But now that the damage is done, the way of addressing the problem is not to suppress further evidence of it, but to air it, to bring it out into the open and to say this is not what America stands for. What America stands for is the humane treatment of prisoners and accountability for past abuses that occurred.
So if they knew that it was a really, first of all, there wasn't going to be very much actionable intelligence achieved through torture, and by torturing people, by abusing people, by sweeping up the wrong people and abusing them in prison, that they were going to deeply alienate those whose country they were invading and occupying, why did they do it?
Well, it's a very good question. It's really, you know, it's, I think that there was some level at which these individuals were not viewed as being human, perhaps. I mean, they were, these acts were essentially dehumanizing. They denied the humanity of the victims. Really, you know, just confirm, you know, just call into question the professional judgment of these the interrogators and the high-level officials who put these torture techniques in place.
What United States agencies were involved in torture and abuse? And to whom did these memos apply to various agencies?
Well, I think, again, you raise a very good question. I think that the links between the CIA methods and the Defense Department methods are not all known, but certainly they all seem to be derived from the SEER methods of training, which the Army has used in order to train its personnel to withstand interrogation from enemy captors. There was no prior practice of implementing these so-called SERE, SEER, Survival, Escape, Resistance, Evasion, techniques to use them offensively to obtain intelligence. And yet, both the Defense Department and the CIA went ahead and applied these techniques offensively. The next thing we know, this is, you know, widespread and systemic use of torture.
Were there private corporate contractors as well as government employees involved in this torture and abuse?
Well, yes, certainly there were psychologists who were contracted with to recommend techniques, these SEER methods. Mitchell and Jensen are names that have been uncovered through reporting on this issue. And there certainly were contractors also at Abu Ghraib that participated in abuse. But again, this is something that we don't know all of the facts for, and only confirm the need for an independent investigation.
Tell us about the SEER, S-E-R-E, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. That was, as you said, a training program used for United States personnel that they could draw on if they were ever captured. When and for whom, for what circumstances, was this whole program created?
Well, I don't know all of the history of the program, but I think it's traditionally been used, as you said, to train U.S. military personnel to withstand interrogation at the hands of enemy captors. The program was never designed to be used as an offensive tactic to elicit intelligence on prisoners. But both the CIA and the Defense Department used these SEER methods in a highly unorthodox manner, in a manner that was offensive instead of defensive. And the next thing you knew was that there was a systemic use of torture in place.
So it was basically reverse engineered and put onto other people's lives.
Exactly, without the requisite training and research that was needed in order to determine whether these techniques were even effective, leave alone whether they were illegal. I mean, it's clear that these techniques are illegal, but their effectiveness, again, is something that has consistently been called into question by the FBI. We have numerous documents that confirm that the FBI was objecting to the use of these techniques as being illegal and ineffective, and yet both the Defense Department and the CIA continue to employ them.
To what extent did prisoners die in custody?
Again, something that is not fully known. We know that at least 100 prisoners died in U.S. custody abroad in connection with the post 9/11 detentions. But again, we don't know all of the details, and there may be many more cases that haven't been brought to light.
What are the legal issues involved? What crimes were committed?
Well, I think that torture is a crime, and a lot of what was described in these memos is torture. But who is ultimately responsible is should be the subject of a criminal investigation.
There is a kind of madness to this, and that is the enjoyment that some people take. And again, it happens at all levels. I mean, from, you know, traffic cop to President of the United States to young soldiers. And that is an enjoyment some people take in using and abusing power. This seems to be part of the human condition, is it helpful to try to understand it on a psychological level, to understand that phenomenon itself?
Well, I think it is always helpful to try and understand as much as we possibly can about the circumstances under which potential war crimes were committed, because there's always the possibility that that people will be tempted to commit these crimes yet again. So, of course, it's necessary to you know, understand it. And for this reason, again, a criminal investigation is necessary.
We're talking to Amrit Singh from the ACLU. What evidence do we have? We have these torture memos. We know that there were many dozens of videotapes that were made, that were destroyed. What evidence are you continuing to look for? What do we have? What are you trying to get out of the system?
Well, the Defense Department has informed us that it has a substantial number of photographs of prisoner abuse. A lot of these photographs relate to locations other than Abu Ghraib. And the Defense Department has informed us that these photographs will be turned over to us before May 28th of this year. In addition, we are pressing for the release of documents relating to the destruction of interrogation videotapes of depicting waterboarding and other torture techniques in the context of a contempt motion against the CIA for the destruction of these videotapes.
How does torture sit at this point in the public imagination, and how much of that is influenced by popular movies and TV? And obviously there's a diversity of feeling and opinion about that in the United States, but what's your view on this?
Well, I think there have been some studies that show that programs like 24 have affected people's views on the effectiveness of torture. But I think that ultimately Americans know that torture is un-American, and that value prevails even today. I mean, the United States has been a beacon of freedom and has stood for human rights for a significant period of time, and these memos and what happened at Abu Ghraib, what happened at other locations in Iraq and Afghanistan, all were significant and terrible departure from what the United States has stood for.
It's funny to me that you use the word un-American, because that's so associated with McCarthyism.
Well, I think that it is most Americans' view that torture is un-American. It's not what this country stands for.
How do you feel about the coverage that torture, the torture memos, and these issues have received in the mainstream press?
Well, I think that there has been a significant amount of coverage in these issues and debate around these issues, and that is part of the reason why that we have called for the release of these documents through our Freedom of Information Act request. I mean, the threshold aim of our Freedom of Information Act litigation is to get this information into the public domain so that there can be debate. And obviously, to the extent that there are media outlets that call for accountability, I agree with those calls, because I think that in order to move forward on the issue of prisoner treatment, one must hold individuals accountable for violating the law.
How can future torture and abuse be prevented?
Well, precisely by holding individuals who conducted torture accountable for their violations of the law. That is the way that you can prevent the future use of torture.
My sense of Barack Obama is that he will follow and uphold the rule of law, but in this particular case, he kind of would need a mass movement to really call him to do that, in the sense that there are a lot of people saying that if he expends all his political capital on this, he won't have any left to go around for other issues. How do you see this?
Well, I think that the if the prohibition against torture is to have any meaning, it is essential that there be both criminal investigation by an independent prosecutor and congressional investigation into what happened.
So what are your next steps at the ACLU?
We have continued to call for the disclosure of still secret memos. There is an Office of Inspector General report criticizing the CIA's use of these torture techniques that still remains secret. There is a 2001 presidential directive authorizing the CIA to set up detention facilities abroad that's still secret. There are numerous details about interrogation techniques used by the Defense Department in Afghanistan that are still secret. There are numerous documents that shed light on high-level official involvement in this torture policy that are still secret. We're calling for the turning over of all of this information and for an independent investigation into all of the individuals responsible for the torture and abuse of prisoners.
And if people, for example, listening to the radio today would like to call for this, how do they make their voices heard?
They can certainly call their members of Congress and register their opinions calling for accountability. They can write to government officials reiterating that call for accountability. They can express themselves in the media and call for accountability. There are numerous ways in which concerned individuals can support the ACLU's call for accountability for the widespread and systemic abuse of prisoners.
Is there, to your knowledge, torture going on today by the hands of U.S. personnel against prisoners elsewhere?
Well, there are claims that that prisoners at Guantanamo are still being mistreated, but I'm not in a position to personally comment on those reports. There are reports of them that of abuse still occurring. We don't actually really know, because there is not a whole lot of transparency on the issue of prisoner treatment even today. Well, we take refuge in the fact that President Obama, soon after taking office, announced that the CIA would no longer be using these methods, and that these detention facilities abroad would be closed. So, to some extent, the problem seems to have been recognized. But again, we have to remain watchful.
Amrit Singh, thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Amrit Singh is a staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union. She's co-author, along with Jamil Jaffer, of the book Administration of Torture. And for those of you who live in New Mexico, there is going to be an event. It's the Northern Chapter of the ACLU of New Mexico Annual Meeting and Supper on Tuesday, May 19th at 5:30 at the Unitarian Church here in Santa Fe. For more information, you can call 505-982-8181. And the topic will be My How You've Grown, the ACLU's Evolution During the Bush Years and the Outlook Under Obama, with guest speaker Jerry Rosansky of the National ACLU. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Carlos Vasquez. He is Director of History and Literary Arts at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, nice to be here.
So there is the 7th Annual Latino Writers Conference going on. It's from May 21st through 23rd of this year in Albuquerque. What happens at a writers conference like this?
Well, ours is rather unique in a number of ways. And first of all, it's the first national conference that addresses Latino issues. And it does not limit it to Latinos attending by any means, but it does address Latino issues and Latino writers. And we can't teach you how to write in 2.5 days, but we bring together an array of writers, successfully published writers, poets, screenwriters, playwriters, as well as agents and publishers and editors. And in those 3 days, through workshops and panels, we present to the very limited audience of only 50 people all of the ins and outs of what currently is happening in the publishing and in the writing business and world. And a lot of it does have to do with business, and many times writers forget that and sell themselves short or sell their work short or don't even know how to move their work. And that's primarily what we're about, is connecting people and allowing them to listen to the realistic day-to-day world of publishing in the year 2009.
So how do you see the development of Latino writing and literature in the last 15 or 20 years? It's really changed a great deal.
It's a virtual explosion in every direction, in terms of themes, in terms of the language that people are writing, in terms of the genres that Latinos are moving into. There's a virtual explosion, whether it's in screenwriting, playwriting, novels, short fiction, poetry, all of it. But what is not exploding in equal degrees are the opportunities to get published. As the publishing world contracts, like much of other businesses have contracted, opportunities sometimes are lessened. But I think in time, publishers are going to realize what a lucrative market this is and going to be, and they will begin to change, I think, their approach to things. For example, it's very hard to get anything published in Spanish in this country, and yet there are hundreds of excellent writers that do write primarily in Spanish.
Well, that's an interesting question. How much crossover is there between American Latino writing and the literature of Latin America?
A lot. For our purposes, our themes, both what we present in our writers' conference and the prizes, because we give a literary prize every 2 years, and then another one on an annual basis, two different prizes. We're interested in Latinos writing about their experience in this country, not necessarily the experience of Latin America. But it stands to reason that the globalization that is taking place and the urbanization that is taking place in much of Latin America mirrors much of what happens in this country. So, in effect, there is quite a bit of crossover. And as you know, there's a growing market for whether it's television, radio, or print media in the Latino community.
There are obviously the issues of the business of writing, and there will be workshops on poetry and screenwriting and memoir and the web and publishing and all sorts of things. What about the issues themselves, like the political and social issues that Latinos are engaged in the United States and in their writing? Are you working with some of those, too, at the conference?
They come up. They come up from the participants themselves. We don't try to lead them either in the direction of doing more books on the killing of young women in Juan Juarez area or in some kind of issue about economics or political sovereignty, but rather they bring up their own issues. And in a way, we follow it. The ways of literature, I don't think, are made by any one institution, and we surely don't plan to. But every year, both ourselves and our teachers, our faculty, our presenters, are amazed by the level and the quality and the complexity of issues that people are raising. People have many of the same issues: alienation, loneliness, a failure in their personal life, in their social life. And so those issues, they come up out of the literature itself. It emerges from the literature.
This is the seventh year that you will be doing the National Latino Writers Conference in Albuquerque. Do you have people who were there in the early years coming back and telling you about how that conference affected them and their work and their life trajectory?
In fact, two of our faculty members came to the conference years ago as neophytes and beginning to publish their first works and have moved on, and they are now in the position to be able to share their experience with others. That's one thing that I think has kept our conference so alive and so well attended, And that is that a lot of people have had the opportunity to meet editors, publishers, and to learn how to get their work published. And we've had a lot of success stories. And what's fun is to watch them develop and, as I say, come back years later and be faculty themselves.
So in addition to everything else, you're having a performance by the comedian Michael Quesada and and the Diego Arencon Latin Jazz Quintet.
Right. We usually have what we call a public program one night of the conference so that people, because we get people from all over the country, Canada and Mexico, that come to the conference. And we keep them so busy from 8 in the morning to late at night that we want to have at least one evening where they come in contact with local communities. So this year we're having a presentation by a comedian and also by a jazz quintet, and it's open to the public. Of course, all the people that are at the conference will attend it, and you get to smell the grease and meet the crowd again.
So people are coming from all over the country?
Yeah, they come from all over, right. But we get a really interesting array of people. A lot of people from the East Coast, from both coasts, actually, and just pretty much all over.
It must be such a great, I mean, besides the workshops and events themselves, it must just be such a great opportunity for writers whose work is by necessity often done in isolation, you know, in front of their computer or whatever, to actually meet each other and meet people who are of similar, working with similar concerns.
This is precisely why we limit the attendance to 50 people, because we bring in almost 20 presenters. And we have a 22-acre campus with libraries and patios and places where they can sit and talk. And the intimacy provides and allows a great deal of exchange. And sometimes that's all people need is encouragement from others that are facing the same kind of dilemmas. Because writing can be a very lonely endeavor. But getting published requires other folks to help you. And share their experiences with you.
So is it still possible for people to register for the conference?
Yeah, we still have, I think, between 3 and 5 spots open. Today was the last day to register. We're going to extend it a few more days. There's still some spots open. But we're pretty adamant about not letting it get too big. That's the other unique part of our conference. Unique conferences have over 100 people, and they can work, and they do work. But the intimacy and the extended number of hours that people have access to writers and authors and publishers and editors and agents, especially agents, the time gets cut down. But in addition to the 3 days in on Saturday morning before the conference ends, we have structured interviews. Everybody has at least 10 minutes. If they haven't had 10 minutes or a half hour with an agent, they get it then, or a writer or a publisher or an editor. So people get the full range of contact that they come for.
If people would like to register, they can contact Katie Trujillo by calling 505-724-4747. Carlos Vasquez is Director of History and Literary Arts at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
And the National Hispanic Cultural Center's National Latino Writers Conference is once again May 21st through 23rd. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome poet James McGrath. His new book is called Dreaming Invisible Voices, and he is going to be at the Southwest Literary Center, Recursos de Santa Fe, on Wednesday, May 13th. And he's also going to be at Garcia Street Books on Thursday, May 14th. And the Recursos event is at 7 in the evening, and the Garcia Street Book is at 5 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good. Thank you, Shimmer. It's good to see you.
So these are all poems inspired by nature, mostly by animals. And I guess the original impetus for this collection of poems was the Asian zodiac animal symbols. Is that correct?
Right. I lived in Japan 12 years, and I was just taken by the respect and honor that particular culture gave nature, and particularly those animals.
And did you start writing poems at the time?
I wrote these poems at the time, even though I've been writing for 60 years, maybe.
Good heavens. How would you characterize, I don't know if you can do this, but how would you characterize the difference between the way Japanese people saw animals and the way we do. I mean, what did you learn from that culture?
Well, I learned mainly from that culture this innate respect of that culture for nature, whether it's flowers or mountains or stones, and the animals, they picked these 12 animals that they felt were the ones that greeted Buddha or said goodbye to Buddha when he was dying. And these particular animals kind of represent a certain year, and it's very important that you know that animal, that the year you were born, for instance, because it has certain characteristics which they feel you carry with you.
Right, right. Did you feel, I mean, this is something I always wonder. I mean, there are Asian countries where they eat dogs and where animals are treated very badly, but then there's this literary and philosophical love and respect for animals. Did you see any of those contradictions?
Well, I saw the dog culture. That's the dog culinary culture, I would call it, in the Philippines. But I didn't see it in Japan or Korea, where I was most of my time, but I did see it in the Philippines. And I don't know that it was done other than because they were hungry. I don't think it was done for any other reason than that. So you are right.
There's Korean dog culinary culture too.
Yes, I'm sure there was. And I also noticed, having lived in Okinawa for 7 years too, that there was something about local pets being lost and ended up in soup bowls as well.
Right, right. So you wrote these poems in the first person, in the voices of the animals.
I did.
Why did you do that?
I just feel that I have a connection with nature. Kind of growing, I grew up in the Northwest with an Indian uncle and my father was a hunter, and we were just out in nature all the time. So it wasn't unusual for me to take a first person for a stone or a tree or a dog or a deer or a butterfly.
Right.
I mean, it just didn't seem that was strange at all in my life.
Would you like to read one of the poems?
Yes, I would. I think that what I'd like to read is the one for this particular year, which is...
What year are we in now?
We're in the cow year.
The year of the cow.
Year of the cow.
What does that mean?
Well, it means... I think it's a clue in my poem what it means. It means strength. It means simplicity. It means humbleness. And my poem says, if you allow us to live kindly in sweet grassy fields, we would teach you to be tender and humble on earth. And when we give you our milk, we give you our patience, which is our strength. We do not say much to you. It is only when you see your reflection in our soothing eyes that you will know we love you.
James McGrath, his book of poems is called Dreaming Invisible Voices. Now, a major part of this book is the illustration by Margrethe Overbeck. Tell us the story of your meeting her and these your poems and her art coming together.
Well, that is an amazing story. I've been teaching at Ponce de Leon for the past 10 years, working with elders. My group ages, say, between 82 and 99. And Margrethe Overbeck was in my first class, and at that time she was about 90. And she was an amazing woman. She came from Glenwood Springs in Colorado, in a little mining town, and somehow in her training she went to New York and trained in New York, and she found her way back here to the Southwest. But she was in my class, and she ran out of money in Ponce de Leon and had to move to another place. And in the process, she said, James, I have all these sketchbooks, and I don't know what to do with them. They were two boxes of these little 3x5-inch sketchbooks. Would you like them? And I said, oh, I'd love them, Margareta. So in looking them over, I discovered that she had illustrated every one of these poems that I had written 25 years ago.
Independently of knowing you.
Independently of knowing me.
Amazing.
And it was amazing. So that the book is entirely illustrated by her drawings plus the cover. And fortunately, I was able to have the dummy done and gave it to her before she passed away. And she passed away 2 years ago.
The book is called Dreaming Invisible Voices, Poetry by James McGrath and Drawings by Margareta Overbeck. And James will be at the Southwest Literary Center, Recursos de Santa Fe, an evening of poetry and music with Joan Logie and Ray Taylor. It'll start at 7 o'clock. For more information, you can call 982-9301. And then he will be at Garcia Street Books on Thursday, May 14th at 5 o'clock for a book launch and celebration of this book. James McGrath, thanks so much for being here.
Can I add one thing?
Yes.
I'm going to Ireland at the end of the month, and I'm going to be able to launch my book at the Liz Toll Writers Festival in Ireland.
Wonderful.
And I am so excited about that.
Oh, well, you'll have to tell us about it when you get
back. I'll tell you about that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 505-428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.